My name is Jake Ward. I'm the West Coast Bureau Chief of Popular Science Magazine, and I'm just going to spend a moment sort of setting things up, teeing it off a little bit. Popular Science has been around since 1872, and my interest in this, our interest in this, is that we actually have a partnership now with Innocentive, and in getting my mind around what we could do together, I really bumped into something sort of fundamental about what popular science is about and will be about in the future. I mean, we have chronicled innovation since forever, right? I mean, we published Darwin, we published Louis Pasteur, we have an awesome thing from Steinbeck telling people to turn their back on the space race and concentrate on the oceans in 1965, you know. But in every case, the innovations that we were chronicling, even though we champion the sort of garage inventor, most of these innovations happened either in seclusion or they happened within the confines of an organization, right? If you're NASA and headed to the moon, you had to pay a guy to work within NASA to do the work necessary to get you to the moon. And I've thought a lot since we began working with Innocentive and put up a pavilion where now companies can place R&D challenges and get them solved by our audience. I've thought a lot about how that would have changed the history of popular science. If you had the ability to make the connections that we now have back when we were trying to get to the moon, or back when, you know, people were first doing a self-contained, you know, scuba system, or, you know, any of the innovations that we've covered, the pace of change could have been so different. You know, who knows what kind of engine would have been standard in a car? Who knows what kind of, you know, jet propellant they would have used? I think that the history of popular science would have been very different. So anyway, I've been geeking out on this subject a lot. So with me today are Duane Spradlin, President and CEO of Innocentive, and Jack Hughes, immediately to my left here. And we're just going to try and make this as conversational as we can. I mean, there's, you know, the right number here to just talk. So if you want to get involved in the conversation while we're doing this here, please do. You can either get up and stand by the mic there, or I think there's a gentleman over here who will actually walk around with a mic. So just, you know, as we're going, raise your hands. If you want to get involved, please do. It'll help us understand what you're interested in, which is the whole point here. So I'll just start, though, by asking each of these guys. So Jack, let's start with you. Describe the traditional model of innovation and how it compares to how your company works.
So the traditional model of innovation has been that you sort of set up an R&D group or something similar to that. You put a bunch of people in labs and you let them go to work. You let them come up with ideas and fulfill those ideas. And certainly a significant amount of innovation has come out of that. There's been many stories where companies have been started through innovation and then been able to innovate their way to success. There's been an awful lot of stories where they haven't been able to do that, where they've had people in the lab, they've come up with great ideas, and then they haven't been able to market them. But what Topcoder represented was sort of a different way to look at that, and the impetus being the internet, that the ability to connect to people and to connect people to people with ideas and the ability to implement them would change that entirely. And basically, that's what Topcoder is. It started out as really a search to find talented individuals, digital creators, we call them now, because they're everything from software developers to algorithmists to creative folks doing graphic design and so on, and to bring them together to see what could be created. And over the last 10 years, that's grown to about 400,000 members and continues to grow. And we've built various ways for them to put together what they're doing to create real product.
What does it take to be a member? I mean, what's the sort of the ideal member for you?
Ideal member is anyone with an idea or something to contribute in terms of creativity. So we have Topcoder Studio, which is the creative side of Topcoder. We have Topcoder started in algorithms, so a lot of math oriented folks, and then just hardcore software developers. Yeah. So to become a Topcoder member, all you do is register and then start looking around for things to do.
So Duane, tell us about Innocentive's model.
Innocentive was founded 10 years ago, and it was really founded to focus on the very same kind of institutional, kind of a remedy to the institutional innovation problems that, that Jack talked about. Large organizations that have been hiring buildings full of researchers and product developers for years, really looking for better ways to innovate. And InnoCentive was founded by Eli Lilly. It's now a standalone company. But pharmaceutical as an industry for many years has been very cognizant that the cost of innovation has been increasing for years. So I think Eli Lilly quite smartly looked way ahead and recognized that if we don't find a better way to innovate, we may very well find ourselves without that next product going to market at exactly the wrong time. So in 2005, the company was spun out, and we're now focused on industries ranging from aerospace to chemicals to, you know, creating new business plans for organizations. And what we have found is that this this open innovation approach, which I think is now more popularly known as crowdsourcing, and that's really the ability for an organization to connect to innovators all over the world, almost in real time, on demand, is incredibly powerful. And what we've been able to prove out over the last several years is that I think it was a Forbes writer that said there's the trivial and there's the profound. And what we're seeing in crowdsourcing is the profound. So these are organizations that are finding, you know, brand new algorithms and unique approaches to solving mathematical problems, or new polymers for avoiding fingerprints on the front of PDAs. Almost anything that you can imagine that must have previously been invented or developed inside the four walls of the traditional organization can now be developed and imagined outside the four walls of the traditional organization. And that changes everything for these organizations. It means they've got, all of a sudden, access to diverse pools of talent, the ability to get to people with ideas that they had never imagined. I mean, imagine the cross-section of disciplines where if all I've had looking at a problem for years is a mechanical engineer, and now someone coming at it from a related, you know, perspective can now take an entirely new approach to solving that problem. And organizations can do that on demand. So we see government, we see commercial, the commercial sector, we see foundations really beginning to adopt these open innovation or crowdsourcing techniques at a very quickened pace. So we think this fundamentally represents a change in the way that the innovation process happens from sort of monolithic, structured factories of innovators and PhDs to an entire connected planet helping these organizations innovate.
So the I'm trying to imagine, you know, somebody for the first time kind of encountering this model. Let's say, you know, it's someone in the audience, right, who's got a certain set of technical, a certain technical expertise or whatever it is. By the model that you guys work by, is it that that person has already, you know, they bump into a challenge online, right? Or I'm not sure with Topcoder what exactly the parallel is here, but do people tend to have the solution already? Are they already working on the project? Or do they start from nothing in, you know, addressing a challenge, if that makes sense? You know, somebody puts up a challenge that says, I need this very specific thing. Does the person who ends up solving that tend to be somebody who starts from zero or has been working in that field already?
Well, I'll say that, and I think we've got fairly similar ways of engaging our communities between the two companies. So I'll start and let Jack continue. What we have found is that a problem better asked is a problem better answered. And the communities we engage with, so we've got about 250,000 core members, and we reach almost 12 million through partnerships, people around the world solving these problems, is that they're very astute. So they look for well-defined problems. They look for problems that are credible, real, you know, very clearly defined in terms of what makes a solution to that problem. And then often, and generally it's the case with an incentives model, an economic inducement's offered. So it could be $5,000 or $1 million. You know, $5,000 might be enough to get hundreds of people around the world to take a look at a business plan, but it might take $1 million to find a new biomarker for a neglected disease research program. So these kinds of problems, we call them challenges, well-defined, you know, what's the inducement, what's the award if I win the challenge, what does winning look like? That kind of a problem put out there over the internet turns out translates exceedingly well. So what we find is that what we call solvers, these are individuals and teams and, you know, academic institutions and, you know, even companies all over the world, they're looking for a well-defined problem that matches their background. Now, in some cases, they may have something like that off the shelf. In some cases, they may say, well, you know, you've never asked me before, but I know how to solve precisely that problem. In most cases, however, If that's from the industry, that problem would have been found already. What's really interesting is the overwhelming percentage of the time that it's not an individual from that industry or a team from that industry, it's from a related industry. And what they say is that I've got part of that solution, but looking at it from a completely different perspective, I can adapt some of the knowledge I have and some of the techniques I have to solve that problem in your industry. And so it's that diversity. It's being very close to the problem, but with a different set of eyes and a different tool set to bring to bear that's really solving a lot of these problems.
Mm-hmm. So, and Jack, how does it work with you guys? I mean, is it do the people tend to come out of left field in some way, or is it do they have a set of, do they meet a set of criteria sort of ahead of time? Like, what does the community end up looking like that way?
So all of these models sort of have the same, what we call self-selection, meaning problems are posted and then people find them that think they have something to contribute. TopCode is a little different in that it's a digital creation platform. So basically members are coming in and they're creating pieces of products that are developed for customers or governments or what have you. So what we're looking for is the innovative component of a product. Mm-hmm. So that may be a search process. We may be looking for an algorithm to do image recognition, something like that, that's going to be built into a product further on down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody's trying to build a website. Maybe somebody's trying to build a mobile app platform. So we're very much in the digital creation space. So we have sort of two elements. But the way people see that is, and our members are coming for all sorts of different reasons. In some cases, they're just coming to learn or have fun or learn how to program or learn how to do algorithms. We run a tremendous amount of non-commercial activities that engage everyone from high school, middle school kids up to people that work at large technology companies to in a non-commercial sense. And then we run commercial things.
So let me ask, for people in the audience, so if I'm, being at South by Southwest, I can't help but, think, God, I got to think of the next big thing myself, and I got to sell it to somebody and make a bajillion dollars. There's the classic romance of innovation is that you're going to be the first to get an idea to market, and then you're going to command its life. And what you guys are describing is very different. You're plugging into an established relationship sort of at a distance. And I'm curious just sort of what the inducements are for somebody who, has the skills to solve a very important problem, but may not get as much money out of the deal as they would if they were to drive it into the market themselves.
So it's interesting. We're both, if you will, startups, right? I mean, we essentially had to create a market that didn't exist years ago. We had to educate the market on what the right language was. And this notion of crowdsourcing innovations from all over, as much as probably kids graduating high school today might assume, it's been that way for a long time in the real sort of industrial world. This is a very new concept, but we've essentially had to really sort of break through and create that. So we've got that startup mentality, I think. And so this is something that's very, very, very near and dear. And I'll give you two points of view on this. The first one is, if you're a startup company, and let's say you're in Silicon Valley or you're here in Silicon Hills, and your job is to get the next generation wireless network router to market, and you identify at the last minute that you've got a heat dissipation problem, or you need an alternate packaging solution. As a startup, you're very, very frugal and economical in terms of dollars. You're looking for every opportunity to get that unique breakthrough to market. But you couldn't possibly have the staffing of the big boys. You couldn't possibly have all the resources of a Cisco and others. So what's very interesting here is part of this is about the breakthrough, right? And part of this is about getting access to diverse talent pools in real time. So if I'm a startup company, and I want to focus on, whatever that breakthrough is on better wireless network, router technology, do that. But you are at a greater advantage and you're able to play against the big boys much more effectively by being able to tap these pools on demand in real time to help solve the problems as you try to get that product to market. And I think the second thing that I would add to this is we do this ourselves. So, you have to eat your own dog food. So, we're running challenges right now to help us identify feature sets for our next set of products. We ask our solver community to tell us what to do next. So you know what? I think that that startup mentality, whether it's a startup company or, you know, a new product going to market for a Fortune 500 company, you're constantly thinking about what's next. You're constantly looking for opportunities to use all the resources at your disposal. I think that's the right way to think about crowdsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
And it de-risks the process. Because actually, if you're trying to get that product to market and you get it out 60 days before the competition, that's winning or losing in most fields.
Mm-hmm.
So if this helps get those products to market, if this helps get that breakthrough to market, and that's what your investors are looking for, you should use every tool in your arsenal.
So just to add to that, and just to go back to the example, let's say you do want to start a company. Let's say you have a great idea, and it's for a software, it's for social network or some communications mechanism on the internet. The normal process is you have that idea, you go find two or three people and try to pull them together and get them to do it with you. You try to find a couple of programmers, you try to pay them with whatever food you can give them and so on. The question is, why wouldn't you just do that on the internet? Why can't you just find that on the internet? I have the idea, I need some people to help me with it. Then it becomes about what are the mechanisms, what communities can you tap into to help do that? It's the same thing if you're trying to develop a product inside of a company. Instead of having to go through the process of going to find people, hiring them, going through all of that, that expertise exists outside. The question then becomes, what are the right mechanisms to make sure value is transferred, value is captured? You don't want somebody contributing to something that has a tremendous upside that didn't get paid anything for it. So building those mechanisms is what we do. And it's very interesting to try to get it right because I think these are going to become predominant mechanisms for how people do start businesses, how they do start products. Yeah.
Again, if anyone has any questions, we'd love to hear them early here. Can we get the mic to this gentleman in the front row here?
Thanks. I guess my question came out of the comment that Mr. Hughes just made. If multiple people are contributing to a product and someone contributes a significant piece of value to the product, who owns the IP? There's no patent concept currently for crowdsourced patents or crowdsourced IP. If this work is being done by a group of individuals on behalf of a large corporation, and the corporation is going to want to own some IP, yet some people may be unwilling to contribute their best ideas if they can't have part ownership.
That's right.
How do you see that evolving?
That is a great question, the million-dollar question.
So I'll just give my perspective, and then Dwayne can jump in. But patents and patent law, the patent process itself, is not conducive to the current environment of how ideas are generated and how they get patented. That process itself is going to have to change. Obviously, it's a regulatory process that's going to be slow to change. But it will also be innovative, and it'll have to be. So there are companies working on crowdsourced solutions to look at just how you do that. So there's people out there that are crowdsourcing prior art, for instance. There's people out there that are thinking about, including us, about how do you patent ideas, how do you make that part of this process. And then there are things that just shouldn't be patented. There's no reason to patent them again. They've already been thought of in some context or another. And to some degree, there's been this sort of back and forth in the patent world about what's the right level of protecting an idea versus stopping progress. And that's a really tough question to answer. It's going to have to evolve over time. But the internet and people's ability to innovate will help that process along.
Do you have in your mind a perfect, patent regime under which Topcoder would function the way you dream it would?
I don't know if there's a perfect patent regime. We have ideas of how you would do this. Topcoder, for one thing, is very granular. So we're looking at innovation on a component level, a piece part level. So we have visibility into saying, is this idea really patentable because it's so precise in a particular area? And if it is, you can put that right into the process of saying, we're going to stop, we're going to file a provisional patent, we're going to do the prior art search, or we're going to hand it off to somebody else who does, or we're going to have algorithms do it or whatever, or write algorithms to do it. So there's a whole host of things you can do, and we have given it a fair amount of thought, because we are on that same, how do you bring a product to market, and part of that is what are the IP issues.
Right. Dwayne, I know that it's with InnoCentive, it's oftentimes less granular than that, because, I mean, so we just one of the popular science readers solved a problem for the Air Force where it was a fast glove rope challenge. How do you slide out of a helicopter on a rope without burning your hands to death, basically? And so this guy had come up with a great idea for it. And, you know, that's the bread and butter of popular science is those kinds of inventions. But that is exactly this issue. You know, that guy had intellectual property over it and presumably is transferring it to the Air Force.
Yeah, the... And that's a phenomenal challenge and story. If anybody's interested, I would say that you've got to look at the question and break the answer up in a couple of different ways. At least in our world, what we have seen is that commercial entities obviously care more about the IP treatment than the non-commercial entities do, largely.
You say non-commercial entities, you mean?
So I'll give you some examples. So when we work, you know. If we work with the Rockefeller Foundation or the Gates Foundation, typically they're looking for new approaches to say, you know, problems in developing countries. How do we better, how do we slow the spread of malaria? How do we distribute vaccines in sub-Saharan Africa more effectively? So those things tend not to be concerns there. But for commercial entities, they tend to be very much the concerns. And so we've created a basic, we called them challenges earlier, right? These well-defined problems. Each well-defined problem for us includes whatever the appropriate IP treatment is for that problem. So if you're looking for ideas, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to patent just a broad idea. So we have, you know, and it's also very difficult to sort of lock down a community in such a way that you could contain that idea as a form of sort of, you know, sanitized prior art anyway. So we tend to, when we look for ideas, what we call brainstorms or ideation challenges, those tend to be very open and collaborative. But when we start moving into actually creating definable IP that could be patented, then we'll typically take what we call the seekers, the organizations looking for the discovery, the invention, and we'll run them anonymously so you won't even know who they are. Mm. We'll cleanse the problem so you won't even know what the application is. Each one of the solutions that come in are coming in through sort of online documentation. You've signed non-confidentiality agreements, and each one of these is sort of protected with a whole regime of IP treatment that's actually been vetted over the course of almost a decade now. So what we find is for commercial entities, we can protect their IP to a point that they can generally patent it exclusively after the fact. But it really depends on the kind of challenge you're running. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for ideas, we typically wouldn't do that. If you're a foundation, we typically wouldn't do that. But if it's a chemicals company or an electronics company that wants a very specific innovation that they think will create a competitive advantage, we'll wrap an IP treatment around that, and we've been exceedingly successful in doing that over the years.
So just to follow on the gentleman's question, then, for the solver, right, the person who came up with the idea, like the Fast Love Challenge, what's the inducement for them to hand over intellectual property rights?
So it's a great question. So first of all, again, part of a problem asked, you know, we said earlier, a problem asked well is a problem answered well. So part of the problem for us, what we call the challenge, it states what the requirements are, what the solver, individual, team, organization will be required to do, and then what the inducements are as all part of the package up front. They know precisely what's being asked of them. They know if it's going to be confidential. They know if they have to transfer the IP rights, so on and so forth. So as a consequence of that, they can simply choose not to participate. If they do participate, there's a set of rules that get followed. And they will, you know, depending on the type of challenge, in exchange for $50,000 or $100,000, they may be transferring, you know, in perpetuity, exclusive IP rights. They may also not be. We're finding as organizations get more and more used to this, it's actually interesting how many are beginning to realize how little of the time they actually have to do exclusive IP transfer. Hmm. In many cases, particularly in areas of where you're trying to spawn an industry or just drive an area forward, government's doing this quite a bit. The government wants to incent innovation in many different areas. They're leaving the IP entirely with the winning solvers. Hmm. They're saying, look, what we want to do is we want to drive innovation in robotics. We don't want to take that away from you. So here's a whole, you know, here's a whole sort of award or inducement series that's designed for you, but you can keep the IP. But again, typically, if you're a commercial entity, you probably want that.
Right.
And the solver knows exactly what they're getting into when they begin. And if they don't think it's enough money for the solution, then they simply won't participate.
Yeah.
Which means the solutions that come in under these kinds of regimes, the solvers are generally more than happy to participate.
Yeah.
In fact, in some ways, particularly for individual solvers, you could call it found money. They wouldn't have seen the opportunity otherwise. Again, they may be coming from a related industry. And as a consequence of that, they wouldn't have had that opportunity. Now they've got a way to participate. $50,000, $100,000, that's easy for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's an easy decision to make.
This gentleman here in, with the... We had a mic. Oh, here we go. Thank you.
Hey.
Sorry.
What's up?
My name is Sean. I work for IDEO.org. And... My colleagues at IDEO run OpenIDEO,
yes.
And one of the reasons that they've been really successful is this idea of collaboration among the individual contributors to the community. Then once an idea is contributed, there's a lot of sort of back and forth collaboration where there's ideation, where individual community members are working with each other to build on top of the initial idea, so that in many ways the concepts sort of morph and improve based upon feedback and collaboration among the community.
Sorry, just to clarify, so an idea comes in, somebody puts out a challenge, right? And then within IDEO, you guys are figuring it out yourselves? No.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So OpenIDEO is very similar to what you guys are describing,
right.
Except that it's not for profit, but it's, again, a challenge is presented, and then individual contributors give ideas for solving the challenge. And then there's a sort of back and forth period over a month or so where they're actually... The users are commenting and working with each other to sort of improve on the submissions. But again, it's all crowdsourced and it's all open innovation. But one thing that's why it's different than what you guys are doing is there's individual prize winners for you guys, it sounds like. And as a result, I wonder if there's less of an incentive for there to be sort of collaboration among the contributors to the community. And I just wonder if you guys have had thoughts on that or if you've come up with any way to actually get, if you have 10,000 people participating in a challenge, you have 10,000 separate ideas, but they might be even stronger if those 10,000 people could be talking to each other to get an even better idea.
So yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah,
basically, I mean, as I understand it, right, what you're asking is, by the models that you guys have of your companies, is there a model by which it's not just 10,000 individual submissions in parallel, but an idea comes in that gets bounced around, iterated among the community, that kind of idea.
Right, as opposed to sort of siloing the ideas,
right,
because
right.
Everyone's sort of competing against everyone else to win the prize.
Yeah.
So yeah, in TopCoder, we spend a lot of time thinking about collaboration versus individual contribution, right? And we look at it about as scientifically as we can. We actually run experiments. We do them with academic institutions because we're really trying to understand where do you collaborate, where do you individually contribute, what is the right mix. What we do is very much the process you just described that happens online. So there will be an idea that's put out there. It will get a lot of dialogue from different members saying, did you really want to do it this way, or shouldn't we do it that way, or shouldn't we? And what's interesting is they may be a contributor, but they're all asking questions of each other and of the ultimate consumer to say, you know, is this a better way to do this? So, and if it is, what will happen is that'll get incorporated in the design for what's going to get contributed.
It's a great question. So that we have, I think I mentioned earlier, we have a whole architecture of challenges that we use based upon what an organization wants to do. And, you know, to give you an example, you can run an ideation challenge for ideas and a theoretical challenge to get a theoretical approach to solving a problem, and then a reduction to practice challenge to get an actual solution that I can test in my product organization. You can chain these together or start anywhere you want to. So they're kind of like Lego blocks in that sense. Well, two very important Lego blocks that we have are what we call, the first one is called a brainstorm challenge. And this tends to be used largely today for open collaborative challenges, meaning people can see each other's solutions, they can build on each other's solutions, much like you described. Now, you know, to contrast that with the prior question from the gentleman over here, if you're looking to lock down IP, you're probably not going to do it in an open collaborative challenge.
You don't think Eli Lilly would be knocking around ideas?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
But there are applications for that which are absolutely brilliant. So we use brainstorm challenges for that, but particularly with big commercial clients, that will be slow in adoption for them. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that we do isn't really so much a challenge type as a form of a solution, which is we allow what are called team project rooms. It took us almost a year to build these, but a team project room is actually not an individual signing a confidentiality agreement. It's a team. And so a team leader creates a project room. They identify five people that they think can uniquely work on that. They're all competing as a single entity. And if they win the solution, they split the solution dollars accordingly. But that is treated as a singular submission, and the IP can be transferred on behalf of the group, and it's all been vetted by lawyers and attorneys, and it works exceedingly well. So particularly for commercial entities, they tend to be relying on these team project rooms as ways to manage confidentiality and information. But in that foundation space and the government space that you describe, we're using brainstorm challenges as a way almost to create an open town hall for ideas, but it'll be very seldom there that, you know, something's patentable. Again, back to the prior question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I wonder a little bit just about sort of the thinking about gaming this out, right, where people are using these kinds of, you know, this kind of distributed innovation, this crowdsourcing more and more and more going forward. What does that do to the culture of work, right? I'm thinking, not to slag off IBM here, but, you know, the IBM commercials right now, I'm an IBMer, right? There's this pride in belonging kind of, that's sort of the traditionally associated with being part of an innovative company and da da da. So if we end up in a world where it's, you know, small teams outsourcing a lot of innovation to people all over the world, what does that do to the culture of work? I'm not sure I prefer that to how I work now, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so you know, I don't think the IBMs, the Googles, the Facebooks, or the next ones of those are going away. These are models that add a level of leverage to a traditional organization. And there are four people. So Topcutter has sort of two types of members, if you want to call it that. Some are that do this full time, and some of them make a lot of money doing it. Many, many, many of them are doing it because they have something to contribute in a particular area that they want to contribute. Many times they're contributing just because they want to learn how to do object-oriented software development. Yeah. But they will be contributing, whether it's in Topcutter or in Ocentive or what have you, because they have an interest level that allows them to contribute. That may be in addition to their day job, that may be instead of their day job. For many people, it will become that this is their day job because they can work for 20 companies instead of just one. So I don't think it's going to...
Have you seen that model yet? Has that come to pass?
Sure, Topcutter, that's absolutely. People members are, that absolutely have had worked for 20 different companies.
Well, and they're making their entire salary, in theory, through service you provide. That's interesting.
And they choose to do it because they want to live where they want to live, do what they want to do. They don't want to be bound up by a corporate regime and meetings and being told what they have to do and all of that.
Do you have any regrets about sort of killing off the office, you know, Christmas party? I mean, when will people get drunk together?
I still go to the office Christmas party, yeah, and I think most people do. I mean, I don't think companies are going away. I think they, like so many things, you know, I think the assembly line's going away. I think it should. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to be doing that. People should be doing their highest best use, and that's sort of what some of these models, I think, will entail.
So in this constellation of people who have the skills you need, their greatest shining moment just comes down and connects to the right project at the right time.
Yeah, if you've sort of done the model right. What one of the things we found, and I'm sure Duane will say the same thing, is there are no lack of problems. There's not the slightest lack of problems. There's an unending list of problems. Mm. So that shows you in the supply-demand equation, there's a lot of stuff to do. You know, these are going to, they are disruptive models. People can feel like, oh, you know, what's going to happen and all that. You know, Topcutter hasn't replaced any large body of employees and isn't going to anytime soon.
Right.
And I don't think Ocentive is either. So.
Well, I think that...
yeah, with all due respect.
But I should.
You know, they say that talking about millennials, they say that kids graduating from college today will have no less than eight jobs. And I think we're very quickly moving to a very different sort of, you know, what's the new normal? And I think the new normal from a work perspective is that increasingly work will be project-based. And, you know, we've all bought probably very large LinkedIn networks, and at least what I've seen since the recession is just the stunning number of people I know that are now consultants on LinkedIn, which I think is unemployed now these days. And what that means to me is that we have an enormous number of people that know that they're going to work on individual projects. They might, you know, their particular passion and skill set may be in, you know, high-end, you know, marketing programs. And there's a ton of organizations around the country and around the world that need that expertise and can access it now over the internet, real-time communications. We've got all the infrastructure to do that. And as, you know, as Jack said, that's a much more efficient form. Well, I think what's happening is I think generally, you know, it's probably the case that the demise of work as we know it may be premature, but I'm guessing that within half a generation, you know, more than half of work that's done is done in more of a project-based mode because it's better for companies. It lets people do what they want to do, what they're passionate about, much more effectively. It's a more economical form and I think a more rewarding form. And I'll give you an example of this, and also this will provide an example of a challenge. So we ran a challenge not that long ago for this happened to be for a chemicals manufacturing company, and they were looking for some sort of an entirely new process on the assembly line that would allow them to do something to, you know, that would adhere to a new set of standards being introduced by a particular government in which they were doing a lot of manufacturing operations. And the organization could not crack the problem. They could not figure out how to essentially pass the new laws with their existing manufacturing process. So they ran the challenge on Innocentive, and, you know, I think within 60 days they had a new process design that worked for them, and that's what they're doing today. But the interesting part of the problem is that the solver was from Canada, and I interviewed him, and what he said was, you know, look, I used to be in academia, I used to work for a large organization, and what I found was they wanted me to do the same thing over and over again. The amount of my time and energy that I got to spend sort of creating, applying my skills, the things I care about, was very low. So he said, now I make my money almost entirely on Innocentive or doing other kinds of project-based work. And he said, I'm having the time of my life. I get to work on the projects I care about when I want to. I've got flexibility with my family. I think that is really, there's more than a nugget. There's an underlying sort of need that people have to work in very different ways, I think, going forward. And I think the economy, quite frankly, is structuring that way anyway. So I think we're on the verge of seeing work evolve very dramatically to a very different form than any of us grew up with on the stage here.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, please.
And I like what you, just to sort of highlight what one of the things you said, Duane, is I forget how you said it. It's, you know, the demise of work or whatever. That we're always going through that. And work is always changing. And it should. It should get different. People should, hopefully, what these models represent are ways to add an element of letting people do what they want to do. And I think that's ultimately what you've got to draw
mm-hmm. from. I have a follow-up question to this, but go ahead. It seems like you have a question.
Related question to what Duane just said. So if people are, you know, day jobbers, is there a need for some kind of a guild structure to enable group health plans, group savings yeah. plans, you know, potentially mentorship plans? You know, where do I go for my ongoing education? I could do it all independently, sure. But one of the benefits currently derived out of corporate structures is, you know, group negotiations,
right.
and lower individual costs, for example, for healthcare.
One interesting example of it is the Freelancers Union. New York is plastered in the subways with ads for this. It's basically a healthcare plan for, and as a media professional, all of my writers tend to belong to it. It's just a way of you know, getting together and commanding the kinds of things that you can really only do otherwise within a company. And so, yeah, that was going to be my question was, what happens to those kinds of benefits under this rule?
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think, you know, those are going to ultimately become parts of these models. There's no way they don't, right? So what's happened is the healthcare benefits, all of that, have been traditionally put on the sort of fraternal, you know, corporation or whatever. They've really struggled under that, right, and squirmed out of it in a lot of cases, and it's falling on the government. That's what's happening. To the extent that there's value created when people do things, which is what we would call work, some portion of that has to be captured in the form of security, benefits, those types of things. You know, these models haven't advanced to the point yet. They're not big enough yet to have grappled with those issues, but they will. And they'll need to grapple with them, and they should. That's part of the value equation, and figuring out that value equation is what these models are going to have to do.
It makes me think of the AFTRA, you know, the American Federation of Television and Radio Announcers. They have a whole thing where if you've worked a certain number of days, then you command a certain level of benefits through that organization. You know, it reminds me of that if somehow you put in enough hours or registered for enough challenges, or I don't know quite what it would be, that maybe there's some level you hit at which you begin to belong to the class, you know, belong to.
Or you take some form of your compensation in that form.
Right, they withhold. Right.
You say, look, I want this part withheld for my benefits.
That's interesting.
I think portability of health insurance, portability of pension plans, these are issues that are emerging for exactly these reasons. So my very strong suspicion is that we're going to see policy need to evolve very quickly over the next 10 years. But there's no question in my mind. You do see in certain industries like media contract-based industries, very heavy on contract and small contractors, where they've essentially created their own infrastructure to help support some of this. But I think largely as you move to the kind of a broader knowledge economy, and that's one of the trends here underlying a lot of the things we're talking about here up on stage, is this movement to a broad project-based knowledge economy. I think that it's probably going to require policy and policy intervention in Washington, as well as as well as some very crafty and opportunistic insurance providers and others to kind of fill this gap. But it's a very real gap. And you know, I think I've got my first kids about to go to college, you know, and I'll tell you, I just spoke at the National Academies a couple of months ago, and I used the opportunity to say a few words about that. And I said, look, with, you know, I'm not sure where my kids work in a few years, but I have a feeling that looking at the way the nature of work is changing, I have a feeling that you know, looking at the United States as a whole, there's an entire rejiggering of kind of the nation's policy around work that needs to happen if we're really going to have not only an effective work regime that can adapt to businesses and sort of the needs of businesses in the country as a whole, but that's really going to allow these kids entering the workforce to have any level of security at all. I think this is a very important topic.
Right. You know, and that's these issues are like really large issues that obviously this country and others are struggling with right now.
We've got 15 minutes. We can sort them out to blow through them. You know, you mentioned a foreign solver, a Canadian. I'm curious about sort of the role of, you know, sort of this. I have to assume that there's a global base of talent that your services open, you know, companies to. And I'm just curious sort of what the role is there.
Let me reimagine your question a little.
Sure, sure.
If you don't mind. I'd almost like to look at it from the point of view of diversity. So, you know, someone who's been very much studying what the kinds of things that Jack's company and my company and many others do today from Harvard Business School, his name's Kareem Lakhani. And he did some work a couple of years ago, which I think was one of really the important early studies on crowdsourcing and why these things work so effectively before perhaps any of us even knew what the words were to describe it. And what they did is they went back and they looked at solutions from Innocentive over the course of a couple of years, and they looked at hundreds. And these were solutions to really daunting problems that had been solved through this process. And what they tried to understand is why these problems were perhaps solved by the people they were solved by. And so it was really a problem in understanding why they weren't solved before and why they were solved now. And to really make sense of the data, what they did, and I call it an inverted tree, they basically looked at all knowledge as a foundation, and think of it as an upside down tree where all knowledge is in the trunk each one of the branches are maybe electronics and chemistry and, you know, maybe corporate planning and pick your various field. And each one of those breaks down into branches and leaves. And at the very bottom is every discrete field of knowledge. For the sake of this discussion, let's say that that's the tree of knowledge. And then what they said is, let's go look at every problem solved using crowdsourcing and where we think that problem should have been solved, and then where was that problem really solved. And so let's say, for example, that that example I used earlier of maybe looking for a material to avoid fingerprints on a PDA is the next big thing. Well, perhaps we think that should have been solved in polymer science. So that's a leaf down at the bottom. And so when they did this exercise across tons of these, what they found was typically the problem was solved no less than six, you know, leafs away. So it wasn't solved by the guy in polymer chemistry. It was solved by the guy in, you know, biological materials. Or it wasn't solved by the marketing specialist. It was solved by, you know, some guy in finance. And what that did was it really set the stage for a discussion around diversity. So what we find is that diversity is everything in our flavor of the model. Diversity is everything. You want to be able to get to as many people that look as different from the traditional problem solvers and knowledge workers in that area as you can. And that's where the richness comes from. So this is why we've got people solving oil spill cleanup problems from the construction industry. This is why we've got people with radio frequency backgrounds solving problems and predicting solar flares for NASA. It's that entirely new, fresh look at the problem which really brings an enormous amount of the value. If what I always say is, if the PhDs in chemistry from Stanford could have solved the problem, they would have solved the problem already, mm-hmm. right? And some problems are sort of too big to leave to the experts, so to speak. What I mean by that is give the entire planet an opportunity to work on that problem. So I do that as a way of maybe getting back to your question. What we find is that organizations have a very narrow view of how these sorts of problems can be worked today. They're in those big buildings full of researchers that Jack talked about, and they've all got perfect pedigrees, and they've been working on the same problems for years. Well, it may very well be that it's that, you know, Indian computer scientist or the PhD in physics from Russia that's able to work on that packaging problem for NASA. So it's both it's a global diversity, it's a diversity of backgrounds. We even find gender differences that are enormous. Mm. On our network, actually, women are slightly better problem solvers per person than men, right? But most organizations are, you know, particularly in science, technology, and engineering fields, are incredibly underrepresented in terms of women. My point is, organizations increasingly need to look at diversity of backgrounds, gender, geographical diversity, all of these things. And if they can essentially, at the very least, augment the work they're doing today with that broad, global, diverse network, that makes for a much more powerful innovation. So that's what open innovation is all about. Mm-hmm. So I think that really looking at that, this does become an easy way to get to problem solvers around the world from, you know, certainly the BRIC countries and others. But I think even more broadly, it's a powerful way to really get to the wealth of the world's potential problem-solving capacity, yeah. And that's what these organizations need to tie into.
Do you find, Jack, that, you know, you talked about needing to, you know, arrive at the proper transfer of value, right, an exchange of value. Does it being a global workforce disrupt that value? I have to assume it does.
No. I shouldn't say no. The global workforce is disrupting mm-hmm. value.
Right,
and that's not going to change. Mm-hmm. It's one world at this point, whether we like it or not. And we in developed nations are going to have to get used to the fact that the developing nations are coming up very fast, mm-hmm. and they're going to. My opinion of that is that's a very good thing. Mm-hmm. It creates a lot of demand on both sides. And as we get to somewhat of an equilibrium in terms of how those markets operate, it can create a tremendous amount of demand.
That's great. Other questions, anybody? Gentleman over here, sorry. Oh, yeah, what?
Could you talk a little bit about the vetting process and what it takes to actually determine a winner of one of your challenges?
Sure. So it's interesting. When we talk about one of the things that we have found that we have to pay enormously important attention to is, again, the construction of the problem to begin with. And if you construct the problem right to begin with, the selection criteria are built into this thing that we call a challenge. We have a really difficult time with complex challenges where the solution, where basically the organization that wants to find the innovation says we'll know it when we see it. It's not right to our community, and we represent our community. It's not right to the participants that are really putting a lot of time and energy in, you know, potentially with a 1 in 10 chance of winning or a 1 in 1,000 chance of winning, right? So we put a lot of energy into making sure that the rules and the selection criteria are clear and transparent. That's one of the things that makes for good building a good community, is that they trust the system and they know it's going to be clean and fair. We generally, depending on the type of challenge, we will actually work side by side with the organization. Now, remember, as we said earlier, the organization may be anonymous, particularly if it's a commercial entity. So we'll work side by side with that entity to make sure that there's a reasonable sort of solution vetting process. Depending on the kind of solution, it may be something that looks like a doctoral thesis, and they'll have people vet this and look at it and make sure that it's credible, and they got to provide all the citations. If it's something like, you know, produce a very small device that does X for me and demonstrate it, it's pretty easy to sort of test those, which get done as well. So, but ultimately, at the end of the day, it's always that organization that makes the final decision. We help manage the process. We help vet it. We make sure the rules are clean, and we represent both parties. So if it looks like the organization running the problem's not being fair in the rules, which is, you know, overwhelmingly they follow the rules, right? They want these systems to work. They want the innovation. Then, you know, we're there to sort of represent the interests of the seeker and the solver in that case, and these systems work exceedingly well.
Go ahead, please.
From our perspective, problem setting is extremely important. What we have found and done is we found that we or our client are probably not going to do that or, frankly, much else better than our community. So the community actually does that as well. They take what the customer is asking for from the standpoint of a broad-based challenge, and they break it down into very discrete pieces and actually set the problems. And then other community members come in and solve that. So even our own platform at this point is imagined by, created by, and implemented by our community.
Gentleman over here.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm a student of Lean, and everything that you said, Mr. Spradlin, about, you know, getting the best diversity and getting lots of different minds looking at this thing sounds like a great way to optimize the whole, and it all makes a lot of sense. My big concern is that the other thing that you have to have in order to make Lean work is freedom from fear. And it seems to me that if this is the way work is going to go in the future, I need to move to Denmark or somewhere else that's got a good, solid safety net really soon, because when I'm between projects, I'm going to get very, very hungry. If the Obamacare debate of a couple of years ago is an example of how we're going to handle this, we're in deep trouble. I mean, it sounds like we've socialized the expertise, but not the support, not the compensation.
So sort of the concern being that a open model like this does away with the safety nets of institutions and the protections that they offer. That's, yeah, an interesting question.
You know what's interesting? We just wrote a book this past year on open innovation markets, and one of the big areas that took a lot of time and a lot of thinking through and a lot of interviews was really trying to understand what this does to the nature of work and sort of these systems now, right? Because these are all complex systems. And, you know, I think you're right. And to get back to the earlier point about the need for policy change and others, these are very real issues. I'll tell you, I suspect that the need for these systems to become more sort of networked and empowered and kind of individually, you know, participatory in nature, the creation of these work nets, if you will, and we've got Tom Malone here in the audience, who I think coined some of these terms, actually. Hi, Tom. Is an exceedingly real issue. I can tell you, I believe that it's very likely that you will see, you know, not only the policy changes that we talked about, but also the need to drive, whether it's private or public sector solutions, to portability of healthcare plans and others, just like we said earlier. I think it's inevitable. And I think that it's going to be inevitable with or without crowdsourcing or open innovation. It's simply the way work is changing. So I couldn't hear all the nuances of your question, I apologize, but you know, I'll just say again that I think fundamentally we're seeing work change. And I think that we're going to see society society and government and policies and even some of these social safety nets have to adapt accordingly.
Jack, do you have any thoughts on the safety net of...
Yeah, it's sort of back to the earlier answer. You've got to sort of separate the two things. The social safety net is obviously a topic of large discussion right now. And as smart as we three are, I don't think we're going to figure that out right now. What I would say is that where the value of these models are sort of what I said at the opening. There's a tremendous amount of value that's unleashed purely because of the medium. Being able to connect somebody with a solution to a problem to somebody who needs a solution to a problem almost immediately through the internet unleashes a tremendous amount of value. That's great. Then the question becomes, how is that value transferred? Who captures that? It's got to be partly the provider. It's got to be partly the consumer. Part of that has to go into the social safety net. Mm-hmm. So those things are absolutely going to be figured out as we go forward. I'd be kidding you if I was going to put myself up as some sort of policy expert. Right. About that.
I think we've got time for one more. Go ahead, sir, please.
What do you do, there we go, specifically to either sort of teach the companies that are putting out challenges or give them a solid structure for asking questions in the best and most clear way when they put these challenges out there?
Sure. So in our case, we have mechanisms where we train companies how to do this. We have an onboarding process. We talk about this platform from a customer's perspective, a corporate customer's perspective, an enterprise customer's perspective, is very sophisticated. So we put them through a training process to bring them into this process.
And we have something kind of similar. What we find is that corporations want to manage this as a business process. So we've got enterprise solutions for businesses. We let individual, you know, small and medium business companies and foundations just run these things themselves. We've got both what we call a facilitated or a high-touch version of these where, you know, we've got, you know, process facilitators that help organizations along. We'll even certify clients and use of the tools, the right way to ask questions. In fact, one of the most popular things we do these days is certifying question askers in organizations. And what we're finding is a lot of organizations are telling us they were surprised how poor they were at asking the right questions to begin with, much less articulating those effectively. So, you know, we're doing certification, corporate platforms, et cetera. But I'll tell you, an individual organization that wants to try these kinds of tools on any of our platforms, you know, with a little bit of coaching and a little bit of help can get on these platforms very easily. And so I would guess that in almost all circles, in 4 or 5 years, I'll bet you there are people in large organizations whose sole job it is to understand the right set of questions, to articulate them to customers, users, business partners, innovation networks like ours, and to essentially manage and facilitate the process. So this stuff's moving along very quickly, particularly in enterprise circles.
All right, our last question.
So just back on the question of social safety net, for those of you who are interested in that topic, there's a long section about that in a book I wrote in 2004 called The Future of Work. I think you might have heard me talk about this day before yesterday. The word we used there was the word guilds to describe these independent associations that would provide a set of services like the ones we're talking about for independent workers. One thing that's in there that I think hasn't come out in the discussion yet is this is not just a matter of governmental policy changes being required. I think there's some real entrepreneurial opportunities there. That is, an awful lot of this can be done without any policy changes. There are ways that today's policies get in the way of what's needed, but even without any change, there's a lot of opportunities for a lot of today's organizations or new ones to provide services to independent workers for all these kind of things.
All right. Tom Malone closing us out. Thank you very much. You guys really appreciate your time and enjoy the lovely weather and have a nice evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.